Okay, I admit it. Sometimes I do go into the YouTube rabbit hole where I watch video after video. And for that reason, I would encourage you to subscribe to the Focus Core YouTube channel. That way, if you also find yourself in that rabbit hole, that you'll have some of the best videos, podcasts and case studies about companies that are thriving in Japan, and you'll be able to see and hear these real life cases that are relevant to you and your business here. So take a moment, open up your app, and subscribe to the Focus Core YouTube channel. Now on to our podcast.
What I found is that you do not only need to be an advocate for the regional headquarter. Basically, one of the biggest part of the role is to also explain to all the other countries doing business with Japan of what is important here, right? Because people tend to forget of how quality driven Japan is and why do you need this? Why do you need so many details? And of course, for Japanese, this is what customers expect. But the amount of questions then we ask, the colleagues ask, overseas teams might get upset, right? So, and this is where you need to constantly explain to them what it takes to be successful with customers in Japan and even with your internal customers in Japan.
Welcome to the Focus Core podcast, where we dive deep into leadership, talent, and the evolving world of business in Japan to help you focus in on your core business. Today, on the Focus Core podcast, we're joined by Carsten Michaelis, CEO for North Asia and President and Representative Director of DHL Global Forwarding Japan. Carsten oversees strategy and growth across Japan, Korea, Mongolia, and the Philippines, which covers air and ocean freight, customs clearance, industrial projects, ocean bulk, motorsports, as well as some warehouse activities. With more than 20 years in forwarding, Carsten started his career in Germany in 1996 and has since held leadership roles across Asia Pacific, including Hong Kong, Bangladesh, Australia, and Singapore. Before his current post in Tokyo, he led DHL's ocean freight business across 21 countries in the region. Carsten is a graduate of Oxford Brookes University, where he earned an honors degree in business and management studies. He currently sits on the Asia Pacific Management Board for DHL Global Forwarding and is based in Tokyo. Welcome, Carsten.
Thank you very much. Wow, that was a very interesting intro. I didn't remember, or thanks for making me recall of all the things I've done over the past almost 30 years.
That's very impressive. So,
Very much.
you're an impressive individual. Let's start talking about leadership. Since you've worked across so many different countries, how do you adjust your leadership approach for each country and culture that you move into?
And yeah, that's a very interesting question. So, I've spent the last 25 plus years in Asia, if I include Australia. And while certain things are very similar, others you have to learn, right? So, what helps me as well is that my wife is from Singapore, so a lot of the customs of how Asians do things may be different and place different priorities on certain topics, whether it's in business or in personal life. You can apply them across various countries, right? So how you do business in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Taiwan, in China is fairly similar. And even in Japan, on certain etiquettes of what is considered polite and impolite, is fairly similar. When it comes to Japan, of course, that's very next level of what is considered as polite and impolite, and what you should do, should not do. So I think in Japan there are more traps, more angles that you can stumble across. But look, I think with a lot of common sense and observing, you can figure out quite a lot of topics. So, and I give you an example. Has nothing to do with business, but when you drive in Japan, what I noticed is basically when somebody lets you in on the expressway, everybody is doing this tick-tock with the hazard lights, right? So, and these simple things I started adapting, and then my colleagues also get they not laugh at me, but they're like, wow, how come you know? Sometimes I think it is just walking around with open ears and eyes and having a look of what others do, and then try to do the same, right? So if the locals do it, it cannot be so wrong if you, as a foreigner, do it. But having said that, right? So of course you need to adapt your management approach. Koreans are different in the way they do business compared to Japanese, compared to the Filipinos, but certain things in and your management principles, they should stay the same. I mean, you should not throw everything overboard of what is important to you as a person, to you as a manager. So certain things, no matter which culture, you should stay true to yourself, otherwise you wouldn't be able, or others wouldn't be able to see who you are as a manager, what's important or not important to you.
It's great. I love that because I think we talk about adjusting for culture, especially people coming into Japan. It's like, ah, oh, Japan's so different. You need to adjust. But we forget as leaders, the reason we were brought in was to be ourselves.
Exactly.
And part of that is having that cultural sensitivity and, like you said, just the common sense of observing what's going on and then filtering that through our own being, which I think is brilliant.
Exactly.
What do you do to be able to build then a high performing team? Because you're doing that across different countries now, and each must be a little bit different. But what do you do that kind of similar through all those different countries?
Yeah, maybe I'm a simple person, so I have a look of what works in other parts of the world and what have I been successful with in the past and what didn't work, so and I try to apply this. I think most important is you do need to identify of who's on your team and who is not, right? So meaning you do need a strong leadership team that can basically run a country or run a function with you, right? So and then do believe in giving them as much freedom as possible. Of course, this only works if you trust them, right? So I try not to micromanage, but I'm fairly deeply involved, and I can get upset if I know more about my leader's business than they know themselves. And I think what's also very important is that you are a leading example. So I'm not opposed to me looking through RFQ documents, looking into the pricing, looking into operations. So I think as a leader, what you preach and what you say, you should live so that your teams get a good idea of how you do things, and hopefully they learn and adapt. But it starts a lot with people, right? So because in forwarding we don't have many assets, so your stronghold is your team and the quality of your team.
That's great. Yeah, when you just, I think the who is always the most important to build off of, right? And creating that and leveraging the people around you. You know, when you come in to it and as an expat, how much do you need to change? Do you feel that you need to shift and move things when you move into different regions?
Depends on the team. When I took over Japan, I felt that there was not much to change. Meaning, you can tweak things. As in, when I say change, not change from a team setup. Things were not broken. It's just to make things better, to make the team more comfortable. Whereas in other countries where you really had specific topics that needed an immediate fix, right? So if you take over a new function, of course, especially if somebody has been in the role before for many, many years, certain things tend to be overlooked, or people have gotten comfortable or stuff, right? So, and these are the things you need to fix and unlock. But if you're a new manager, if you get a new role, it doesn't mean that there's always firefighting, emergency management, and you're not judged by how many people you fire within the first 6 months. You're judged by how well you can orchestrate the team as a functioning unit, and that the team works well together.
That's great. I found, I did a podcast on power structures in Japan because I feel it's a little bit different in Japan in that when you have expats, especially they rotate, every 3 to 5 years in Japan, and there's usually an underlying power structure of someone. Often it's the CFO, but it can be, that's it. But it's someone that's been there a long time, and it's unwritten power, and it's finding that person and being able to bring them into or move them. But you need to know who that one slot is.
Because power structure to me sounds like something bad, right? So it seems like some greater power that at the end runs the company whenever the expat changes. But you are absolutely right that you do need to find that person or these people that know a lot about the business, that can help you, to get up to speed, get insights, and people that are not afraid to speak up. But I, by the way, I also do this outside of my leadership team, right? Because I found it very helpful that with an operation, people that don't necessarily are managers, that you find these people that you can be close to and that are opening up, that trust you, that tell you how things really are, right? Because you can have the best management team, but some people still might have an agenda. They want to look particularly good in front of you, or they don't want you to know certain things. So you need to find people you trust throughout the organization, so that you get a very good picture of what's really happening.
That's brilliant. One of the challenges I find in Japan, and I'd love you to talk around this, is dealing and bridging that gap between HQ expectations and Japan expectations, because I find that tends to be the biggest downfall of CEOs coming into Japan, is they don't realize how to bridge that gap, and that either makes or breaks the CEOs that come into the country from an outside perspective. What's your take on how do you balance those HQ expectations with local business realities?
So here few layers to it. Number one, I'm an advocate for Japan, right? So for DHL Japan within the Asia board. So that I'm in the Asia board already helps to clarify certain things, to share of what's important, not important in Japan. When you talk about HQ, the team in Bonn, of course, that's a whole different animal. But then what I found is that you do not only need to be an advocate for the headquarter, for the regional headquarter. Basically, one of the biggest part of the role is to also explain to all the other countries doing business with Japan of what is important here, right? Because people tend to forget of how quality driven Japan is, and why do you need this? Why do you need so many details? And of course, for Japanese, this is what customers expect. But the amount of questions then we ask, the colleagues ask, overseas teams might get upset, right? So, and this is where you need to constantly explain to them what it takes to be successful with customers in Japan, and even with your internal customers in Japan. The countries that we traditionally have very close relationships with, that we've been doing business with for years, they know. But people outside of this power network or this network, yes, you need to explain a lot of why we ask so many questions, what is important to a customer here, how to win business. For example, when you run RFQs, even though a customer might have two, three, four, five rounds, if you don't do well in round one, for a Japanese customer to make a comeback in round two or three, it's almost impossible. And if you don't know this, if you don't brief overseas, you lose out.
It's great. Yeah, I think it's a lot of, I think ineffective leaders are the ones who tell HQ versus explain and educate, and is, you know, kind of what you've touched on. Now, with DHL, you're working in an operationally complex organization. How do you foster innovation within such a large organization like DHL?
I think there we need to slice down the elephant, right? So, yes, DHL as a group, we have more than 600,000 employees, and that's a big number. But at the end, the growth engine is the team here in Japan, right? So, and you need to empower them. And we have quite a lot of smart people and smart leaders here, not only the management team, but also underneath. And you need to empower them, A, to speak up, and you need to empower them to say, okay, look, you have an idea and let's do it. It is not that every idea will be successful, but if you don't give it a try, if you shoot it down right from the beginning, how can teams learn and grow, right? So, and at the end, the opportunities where you fail are possibly your best learning curves, or this is where you learn what to do different or better. And then whatever the teams do here, again, I'm the advocate on their behalf towards the outside world. I mean, it's not only me communicating, but I can enforce this, right? So they should share then of what has worked well in Japan, what solutions we've delivered, and how other countries can either adopt them or benefit from them. So yeah, talking about the big DHL and how complex things are, then yeah, you're standing in front of a big mountain that you can't climb. So slice it down into manageable pieces, and it
Maybe you
starts
can
here.
share with us maybe one of your toughest transformation initiatives you've led.
It
What did you
wasn't
learn from that?
in Japan. It was when I was Asia Ocean Freight head, so where there was a business unit that was in the past run a bit like a company within the company, and I then took this over and there to cut through the crap, excuse my language, I think that was possibly one of the toughest tasks. So where they made it sound like they're very special, they're very complicated, outsiders cannot understand. But I mean, I had then I did the same. I identified the people that can help me, and together we then also sliced it down so into manageable pieces. And what was then the result is that things were not so complicated. It's just that they made it so complicated that no outsider was able to get in. So that was possibly one of the toughest transformations.
Wow. Okay. What was your takeaway that you learned from that?
I think it just strengthened my approach of whom to trust, whom not to trust. I learned that my gut feeling very often is right about people, about decisions. And again, what I mentioned earlier is you do need to find these core people that can manage this with you. And this, yeah, this one was strengthened my belief in, yeah, the way we've done it was the right way.
Cool. Let's talk a little bit about digital tools. I think, DHL's done a lot around leveraging digital tools to improve the customer experience. What have you seen in the changes?
I started in DHL when we embarked on one of our most ambitious IT projects, which was a complete fail. So basically, the CEO at that time, the global CEO, had to leave. And at that time, our systems were simply not up to the mark. So we always looked at Kühne+Nagel and how great they were. So, but since then, when our new CEO at that time, Tim Scharwath, who recently retired, right? So he then transformed the company. If you look at my DHL or my DHL I today, it is not your standard tracking tool. There's a lot of insights you get, a lot of reports you can download yourself. You can place bookings, you can get your quotes. So this is much more than a standard tracking and tracing tool can do. And here I think we've really set a benchmark when it comes to these online tools. Of course, today everybody is also talking about AI, and we take parts of this into the MyDHLI approach. We do a lot of, when it comes to tracking and tracing, we use AI because what you get back from shipping lines is not always the best. So we integrate AI tools to help us with this, but also in our day-to-day life, the company is now also much more open to test and try in a safe environment how AI can help us.
How's that going in Japan?
Good that you remind me, because this is something I wanted to talk about earlier, right? So I think in Japan, if you ask customers, most of them still prefer spreadsheets,
yeah.
Right? So which we try to convince them that's maybe not the best way. And look, you have quite a lot of companies, Japanese companies, that are changing and that are very progressive. But yes, there's still a lot of them that say, no, I want you that you send me a spreadsheet every day at this time, right? So I think Japan must be the only country where we still have a fax line, because some customers still want to fax some orders, which is fairly unique.
Yeah, how do you go about, educating the client that this will be this will help their P&L in the long run, not hinder their P&L by changing their system? Yes, they have to do some changes. You'll have to use a DHL system instead of an Excel spreadsheet, but this will help give you insights and help you in the long run. How do you bridge those conversations?
I mean, in Japan, you know better than I, things take time. So in there, it's a lot of discussions. It's that you do demos, that you need to convince them and show them that it's not adding complexity, that it's making their life easier. But what you also see, right? So with a lot of management changes in the younger generation in Japan, also taking leadership positions, I think this will this will then accelerate also the adoption of electronic tools of AI. Because when you look at who are the ones basically saying no, it's still more the traditional colleagues, peers, customers that have this opinion.
Okay. Let's move into, talking about global logistics and strategy. And let's, how has DHL's ocean freight strategy evolved in APAC over the last decade, do you think?
I think we've become more adventurous to try new things. I think we've broadened our business model, because when I started in 2011, it was still very main trade driven, Asia, Europe, Asia, US, intra-Asia. I think we've broadened that and have ventured into many other trades on a successful basis. I think we've also improved our business portfolio. We acquired Hillebrand, which is still a standalone for beer, wine, and spirits, but we as DHL have taken their ocean bulk flexi tank ISO tank business for non-beer, wine, and spirit commodities into our own DHL operation. So there's much more we can offer, right? So, and I think we are more focused now on which customers, which industries are a fit, and we develop specific solutions. I think 15, 20 years ago, we wanted to please everybody, so to run RFQs for the same customer, and but still after 10 years they don't give you any business. I mean, I think we've become a bit smarter of to identify who wants to work with us, who doesn't want to work with us, or how do we have to adjust our offering in order to make us more attractive to our target customers.
Staying on that for a minute, because I think we have, I mean, in Japan, it's quite interesting that the market is very dominated by domestic companies. And, DHL has so much to offer, and you keep on looking at, all the technologies that are coming out for you guys and all the advantages for companies. How is that affecting your targets within Japan as well, and trying to reach deeper into the Japanese organizations that you're as target companies?
Yeah, and in Japan, yeah, indeed, the Japanese forwarders are dominant. And yeah, in Japan, it's really a very different when we compete, it's a very different group of peers that we compete with. But you do need to get into the Japanese customers, right? Because otherwise, if you only rely on international companies, you will never grow the way the company expects us to grow. So, and what we do need to do is, number one, we do need to adapt a bit of how we do business in Japan and how the Japanese forwarders are successful, and what can we do in order to be a bit more like this. But at the same time, we do need to play to our strength, right? So, and when it comes to go green, if it comes to decarbonization, if it comes to systems, visibility, AI tools, I do think we do have a very valid place here at the table, and we do see this, right? So in Japan, the other topic is, right, so the most difficult part is gaining a new customer to walk through the door. Once you become an incumbent, a lot of things get easier. But we still see many cases where a Japanese customer will stick to their provider because they have done this for the past 10, 15, 20 years, even if it's obvious that our service offering, that our pricing is more competitive. Sometimes Japanese customers still say, sorry, we value the relationship and we do not want to change. So, and this then you really need to be persistent and wait for the right moment. In China, customers, some customers change for $50. In Japan, you need to be aware that it takes much more time, which you obviously know, but the outside world does not always know.
Yeah, that the dedication is something that I've never seen elsewhere as much as in Japan. I mean, a lot of companies still have that relationship base. A lot of countries still have that relationship base. Japan just seems to be uber strong on that. But what I've noticed is that's changing, and that I feel like from the outside and as a recruiter, that a lot of Japanese companies have an appetite and a need and a desire to work with foreign companies now, just for a greater global understanding and much more than, say, pre-pandemic. Are you, does that feel, does that resonate with you as well?
Yeah, because you've the logistics world has changed, right? So a lot more uncertainties, and it's becoming more unpredictable. I think the first big wave of changes how Japanese do business was when the three Japanese shipping lines merged into one, right? So in the past, they could juggle between K Line, MOL, NYK. All of a sudden, so it was not possible anymore. So they were forced to work with some other partners. And in the forwarding space, you feel the same, right? So some Japanese companies deliberately say, look, we do need to reduce the share of Japanese forwarders. Even though the local team still tells them, no, it has to be a Japanese forwarder. But I think there are more complexities and you do need a broader base of service providers to really pick the best for the best lane for the best service. Yeah, because if you other countries are changing very rapidly, right? So and if whether it's in Japan or also my home country, Germany, if you just stick for too long to what has worked for a very long time, if you are reluctant to change, sometimes the result and what you face is not very pleasant, right? So, because others are overtaking others, the areas that you were strong in, they're breaking into these because you were too reluctant to see that the outside world is changing.
Well, that's we haven't touched about you mentioned a little bit about sustainability. Talk about what DHL is doing around that and how they're kind of leading the field in sustainability around forwarding.
We have also target to be carbon neutral by 2050. And with 600,000 people, it's a lot of aircraft and a lot of delivery vehicles. That's quite an undertaking. So there's a very clear mandate, A, that our buildings, they need to be carbon neutral. We are upgrading our last mile fleets a lot to electric or hybrid or hydrogen vehicles. And we do a lot when it comes to sustainable aviation fuels, sustainable marine fuels. I have to say, in Japan, DHL Express is one of the most successful in selling sustainable aviation fuels. So their pickup rates are amazing. So this is something we in global forwarding can learn. And also see how we can get better. There's a very huge shift now that not only in Japan but globally we do train our workforce in our that they can present properly our offerings, that they can talk intelligently to a customer of what we can do and also how it works, right? So that whenever you go to a customer and you talk about your offerings that sustainability should be really a part of that.
That's great. Do you think Japan is adapting as well? I mean, you've talked about DHL Express, but overall, do you think Japan is adapting as rapidly as the rest of the world?
If you're inside Japan, you will possibly say Japan is changing and adapting at lightning speed. If you are outside of Japan, you would possibly say, maybe not, right? So, and I give you a very simple example. I would love to have much more electric vehicles, but we do a lot of long haul. For example, we go pick up in Fukushima on a daily basis. Currently, there is no 10-ton truck or container truck that you can do this with in order to make the journey back and forth. So the trucks are lacking, plus the infrastructure is lacking because there are not enough charging stations around Japan. For city deliveries, this is workable, but in global forwarding, our business is different. Yeah. So, and when you talk to customers, a lot of them are saying, yeah, we're looking at scope one and how we can optimize our processes. Nobody, not nobody, very small amount of customers is looking at scope three.
Is it much of a, when companies are really looking at providers, is it that much of a decision to make a difference, or is it just kind of something that's nice to have, but they're really looking at price,
It depends on
and a
the
service?
industry and depends on where the customer is from. I mean, some Japanese companies that have internationalized, for them it is important. For a lot of customers in Europe, it is important, but maybe more for the healthcare clients and not for the ones producing fiber boards. And if you then go across the Pacific, I think that the topic is not so relevant.
That's a feeling that I get. I work with like have a big pharma client I work with, and digital footprint is it most of their decision making, even in Japan, whether they have meetings or not, for example. It's just a thing. So,
We
but
have a we have pharma with pharma clients that produce very similar products that compete in the same market. One from Europe that sees sustainability as a competitive advantage, and one from the US who says we couldn't care less.
so I got some quick fire questions for you, Karsten. And what keeps you motivated after nearly 3 decades in the industry?
I don't know anything else. And somehow I find it still fascinating, right? So to see ships, to spend time in the port, to see aircrafts, to see big machines getting loaded, unloaded, finding solutions for that. I don't know. It's still fascinating. And I've worked for companies that managed to offer me interesting new challenges and opportunities so that it doesn't feel boring, or yeah, I'm not tired yet, so it's all good.
That's brilliant. And just as a recruiting thing, anybody who wants to learn a lot, go into DHL. They're great at internal transfers and teaching people and moving people around to learn. It's a wonderful client. Sorry, little recruitment pitch for you there, Karsten. But
Thank you very much.
what's a typical morning routine that sets you up for success?
I'm an early riser, so I typically, depending on how late it was the night before, but typically I get up between 5 to 5:30. This morning I got up at 4 because I needed to make sure I prepare for our discussion sufficiently. But usually either I go for a run in the morning, or I get the emails out of the way because I really don't like it coming into the office and then already a gazillion things are happening and you are not up to date. So yeah.
Brilliant. So one of the things that we share, and good luck on your marathon on Sunday.
Thank you so
What
much.
book, podcast, or mentor has most influenced your leadership style?
I do need to read more, so I wish I would say I could say Born to Run, But I think, but I think I've had different mentors, right? So, and I think on your career journey, you have different people that impact your lives. And I had one that unfortunately passed away already when I was still an apprentice, who basically shaped my view of who I want to be, what I want to do. And then also when I was Asia Ocean Freight Head and I reported into the Global Ocean Freight Head, that was also a person that shaped my views and how I want to do business, how I want to be as a leader.
Great. What's your proudest achievement so far at DHL?
A lot of ocean freight topics, so I should add some Japan topics. I mean, maybe I do too. So what I can say was really something where I'm extremely proud of during COVID, where there was no space, no equipment. So my team and I, we took the decision to lease containers, so shippers own containers, because the shipping line said we don't have any. If you bring your own containers, you get good rates and more space. So what started as a project of maybe we do 500 containers, it turned out to be at the end of COVID 130,000 TEUs. So which yeah which helped the company a lot. And when it comes to Japan, I mean, I really truly admire of what the team pulls off when it comes to semicon. So not a secret, we posted about it. We brought in four 747s over Christmas into Chitose with semicon equipment, and knowing semicon equipment needs to stay at around 18 to 23 degrees, and in Chitose it was minus 10. So that was a year worth of planning, that the goods are unloaded, uncrated, and delivered to Rapidus on time, and also at the right temperature setting.
Wow, what a great project, what a great story. And what advice would you give someone starting in a global career in logistics today?
Yeah, if you are curious, if you are open to move and work in different countries, logistics is a very good platform for that, right? So, and I think logistics is very underrated. Everybody says, well, banks or tech companies, which are of course great companies to work for, but I think logistics has this, I don't know, smell or this touch and feel where people say, ugh. But I think it's much more than this. It's not just a commodity that some make it. It's a very interesting field where you do need to find solutions, where I think you get a very good glimpse of what's happening globally, how the economy is doing in a country, in a region, or globally. And it gives you a very good perspective. Is it glitzy and glamorous? No, most of the times not. But it's an honest industry. And yeah, my wife says, looking at the hours I work, she says, what crazy industry do you work for? But yeah, I think it's a very satisfactory one. If you can fix customers' problems and keep shipments moving, keep productions running and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's such a cool service just to be able to move, watch things move around the world, and how it gets to the final user. It's so fascinating.
I mean, this is why I chose logistics, right? Because a lot of friends and peers, they went to an insurance or to a bank where I said, nah, too stiff and too boring and too theoretical. And I wanted to do something business related. And then somebody said, logistics, why? And I said, yeah, it is something that you can touch and feel and see, and it's still very business related and business minded.
If anybody wants to get into logistics, I recommend DHL and
Thank
to
you
reach
very
out to you
much.
guys. It's you guys are a qualified great place to work as well, and
We
the
are.
leadership and a lot of the employees that I've met are world class intelligent people, and that's the people you want to surround yourself with to learn and grow a career. They're just some
Exactly.
wonderful people. So thank you for that. And thank you for spending some time, Karsten. It was great to hear your insights. I so appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being interested in what we do, what I have to say, and I think working with you guys has also helped us a lot. So thanks to you and your team for all the dedication and help.
I'm doing the uptown.